Our text again for this morning is from the Gospel of Luke, chapter 18, verses 31 through 34. Luke 18, verses 31 through 34. Taking the 12, Jesus said to them, "Behold, we are going up to Jerusalem, and everything that is written of the Son of Man by the prophets will be accomplished. For he will be delivered to the Gentiles, and will be mocked, and shamefully treated, and spit upon, and they will scourge him, and kill him, and on the third day he will rise." But they understood none of these things. This saying was hid from them, and they did not grasp what was said. In the Gospel of Luke, as well as in Matthew and Mark, there are three times which Jesus specifically takes the 12 aside and announces to them his forthcoming death and resurrection. The first occasion in Luke 9:22 is immediately following Peter's confession of Jesus as the Messiah. For the first time, Jesus reveals his program. He will die. After the transfiguration experience in Luke 9:44, again, Jesus reveals to the 12 what is going to happen to him. And here for the third time, immediately prior to his coming into Jerusalem, he lays down what is going to happen. This third announcement of his forthcoming death is, in the Gospel of Luke, as well as in Matthew and Mark, the most specific and detailed of the announcements. He tells here where he will die, Jerusalem. He firmly links his death with prophetic fulfillment. This is happening that all the prophecies might be fulfilled. He notes the involvement of the Gentiles in his death, which had not been noted previously, and he makes a rather explicit statement of his sufferings, that he will be scourged and spit upon. It is very clear from the gospel record that the death of Jesus was no accident. It should not be conceived as a martyrdom. Jesus willingly planned and laid down his own life on our behalf. That is the thesis, although bent quite a bit out of shape, of a modern contention that is going around by Jesus, released in a book some 11 years ago by a Dr. Hugh Schoenfield called The Passover Plot, now recently made into a movie and just released in the Southern California area. We have all kinds of things always being released first in Southern California. The movie business these days is hard up for stories in religion because they have found out that it is now selling. So exorcism, the Antichrist, and now Jesus himself are the things which kind of sell. And although in the last 11 years no scholars have paid any serious attention to the Dr. Hugh Schoenfield, Hollywood is. Since a lot of people have read the book and will be seeing the movie and are concerned about what is being said and communicated in it and perhaps will want to have an answer to it, I thought it would be well for our edification today to review the gospel understanding of the plot of Jesus to lay down his life for us and the understanding of this modern author. It is Schoenfield's contention that Jesus of Nazareth believed himself to be the Messiah and literally set about to fulfill all the Old Testament prophecies which were written, especially the ones he was concerned with pertaining to the suffering servant, Isaiah 53. Jesus was a master among men. If you will allow me the latitude, I would understand that the Jesus that the author Schoenfield presents is what I would call a sick genius. For Jesus was able, without extraordinary miraculous abilities, to somehow gather to himself a national movement, and after intensive care and planning, was able to have an unsurpassed following in Judea and Galilee. To fulfill Isaiah 53, Jesus singled out a particular Passover season when his sufferings would be completed. Schoenfield writes, and I quote, "What we chiefly note is that the plans of Jesus were laid with remarkable care for timing. He had singled out a particular Passover as the season when he would suffer, and had taken every precaution to ensure that he would not be arrested beforehand. During the first half of Passion Week, keeping himself to the public eye by conducting his activities in the temple, he had aggravated the ecclesiastical authorities to the pitch that they were determined to destroy him as soon as it would be feasible without risk of a tumult. But he was careful not to help them by staying in the city after dark. Not until Wednesday evening did Jesus apply the pressure that decided Judas to go to the council with an offer to betray him." This is kind of a fundamental thing in his thesis, that Jesus, in effect, psychologically set Judas up, knew where to push the lever psychologically to get him to bait the hook and betray him. So he triggered Judas at the right moment. Judas went to make the arrangements, and by his secret arrangements, he saw to it, that is, Jesus saw to it, that the arrest would not take place until Thursday evening, after he had partaken of the Last Supper with the 12 in Jerusalem. All this suggests that he intended that his crucifixion should be on Friday, which would be the eve of the Sabbath. Calculating that it would require some hours on Friday morning for the council to obtain his condemnation by Pilate, which could not be withheld as the charge against treason from the government was lodged against Jesus, and knowing that in accordance with custom he would not be left on the cross after the Sabbath, but would be taken down well before sunset, which the Sabbath commenced with, Jesus could roughly reckon that he would experience crucifixion for not much more than 3 or 4 hours, whereas normally the agonies of the crucified last for many days. The thing Schoenfield, by the way, fails to note in that last mention is that the agonies of the crucified lasting for many days occurred when people were roped to the cross. It's a considerable difference about one lasting when he's roped to the cross versus one being nailed to the cross, but Schoenfield never bothers to point out that fact. According to this thesis of Jesus carefully planning his death, Schoenfield posits that Jesus had two groups of disciples. I call them Group A, Group B, or Smart Group and Dumb Group. Smart Group includes such people as Joseph of Arimathea, Lazarus, another disciple who is really the John the priest, not John the son of Zebedee, but John a priest from Jerusalem, who is the beloved in John's gospel, and also Nicodemus appears to be in on the act. These are the smart disciples, the ones who are in on the secret plans. Then there's the other group, the 12, from Galilee, the dumb group, who can be depended upon to be carried away with Jesus' plot and to never know the real thing he had up his sleeve. Jesus' plans go according to clockwork. It's an amazing thing that Jesus, without miraculous power or divine sonship, was able to bring off the kind of thing he did. He's placed on the cross. And while he's hanging there, there's a secret signal that's been worked out. He would cry out, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And while everybody was thinking he was calling for Elijah, one of the bystanders, who was really one of his secret allies, would run, give him a drug, which would give him the appearance of death. In fact, it would knock him out. Again, Schoenfield, by the way, fails to note that Jesus first refused the offer of a pain-killing medicine when he began his experience on the cross. He simply wipes that out as not important, evidently. Well, anyway, Jesus all of a sudden looks like he's dead on the cross. So Schoenfield writes, "It is the moment before sundown in Jerusalem. On the hill of Golgotha, three bodies are suspended on crosses. Two, the thieves are dead. The third appears so. This is the drugged body of Jesus of Nazareth, the man who planned his own crucifixion, who contrived to be given a potion to put him into a death-like trance. Now Joseph of Arimathea, bearing clean linen and spices, approaches to recover the still form of Jesus. All seems to be going according to plan." And it was. Except Jesus hadn't counted on one thing. He hadn't counted on somebody coming along with a spear and putting it in his side. And that's where the whole plan goes awry. In fact, he'd have been able to bring the whole thing off if it wasn't for that. But the soldier, just to make sure that he was dead, stabbed him. Schofield then goes on to note that Joseph of Arimathea and a friend quickly take the yet living Jesus from the cross, take him to a private sepulcher where they wrap him in linen saturated with medicinal spices. They lay the body of Jesus in the cool recesses of the tomb. Now there comes the question as to what happens. And again, Schoenfield quoting directly, "Jesus may not have overlooked that he might taste death in spite of the measures he had secretly taken for his survival." You see, the thing was to take him to the sepulcher and get him there for a night and then spring him out and they could go hide him and then help him to recover. But he realized that this plan might backfire. So he had taken some other measures. Whatever would happen, his faith assured him that in some way God would raise him up and receive him until his coming in glory with the clouds of heaven. Jesus knew, however, that his disciples, that's the dumb ones, would be in anguish, not really crediting the prophecies. There can be no clear proof, and there certainly isn't, but we are entitled to imagine him, as we have done, regaining consciousness after he was taken from the tomb, and using these precious minutes to beg his friends to deliver a message to his disciples. He would repeat what was so much a part of him, the scriptures related to his suffering and revival. "Tell them these things," he may have urged. "They must believe. Tell them that when I have risen, I will meet them in Galilee, as I said, and afterwards enter into glory." Of course, it's possible for the secret disciples, the smart group, to spring him out of the tomb because there were no guards at the tomb. That was simply an attempt by the gospel writer Matthew to add a fact that wasn't there. Jesus manages to wake up just at the right time, about 24 hours after his crucifixion, to wake up from the semi-consciousness of the sepulcher, breathe out the word, tell them I'll meet them in Galilee, and this smart group of disciples takes Jesus, buries his remains somewhere, which is still not known to this day, and then sets out to bring the rest of his plan to fulfillment. One of those involved, probably the friend of Joseph of Arimathea, who had assisted him in taking Jesus down from the cross, stays by the sepulcher, and when the women come, he brings them the news. He is not here. He is risen. They get all upset, think it's an angel. Then Mary Magdalene meets the gardener, who was also in on the plot, and she's so hysterical, after all, she had mental problems anyway, that she thinks it's the Lord, and the story starts getting spread that it's the Lord. Then the two disciples are on the road to Emmaus. This same person, or perhaps it was even another person who was in on the plot, comes to the two disciples and lets on that he is Jesus. And Schoenfield, the author, indicates that the real fact of the matter is that Luke, which was written at the end of the first century or the beginning of the second century, had actually stolen his story and remodified it off a pagan story by a guy by the name of Lucius Apuleius. The only problem was that Lucius wrote at 124 A.D., which admittedly is even after the date that Schoenfield describes the Gospel of Luke. In other words, Luke is quoting someone who hasn't yet written, but Schoenfield never bothers to tell you that he's quoting from a story that was told after he says Luke was written, be that as it may. With another wave of the hand, the telling post-resurrection appearances, like the appearance to Peter, the appearance to the 10, the appearance to the 11, where Thomas feels the Lord's marks in his side and in his footprints and in his hand, the prints of the nails, all of these Schoenfield simply deals with in a sentence. They're all highly questionable. Of course, any of the resurrection appearances which attest to the reality and don't involve hysterical women and the like, those, you know, the hysterical ones are okay. We can get a true reconstruction, but the other ones, they're highly questionable. And in fact, he omits the ascension altogether, doesn't even note that it happened and that Jesus continued in his teaching ministry 40 days after his resurrection. Of the Galilean appearance where Jesus is by the shoreside, that is set up by the beloved disciple, this priest from Jerusalem named John, whom we think is John, son of Zebedee. And he gets the disciples all carried away with his great faith, and they mistakenly think it is the Lord. So Schoenfield summarizes, a likely explanation of the circumstances is that all along, beginning with the young man first seen at the tomb by the women, one and the same man was being seen, and he was not Jesus. This man was bent on fulfilling what was perhaps a promise to Jesus when he lay dying after his removal from the tomb on Saturday night, that he would faithfully deliver to Peter and the other disciples a message that the Messiah had risen in accordance with the prophecies, and that they would see him at the place he had told them about in Galilee. The man, who had shown his quality at the cross, did his best. He gave the message to the women and to Mary of Magdala, and spoke also to the disciples who had visited the tomb and were taking the road to Emmaus. But he could not be satisfied. He had not seen Peter and the other 10 and did not know where to find them. When he did get news of them, it was that they had gone back to Galilee. The man followed. He may have been told by Jesus where the rendezvous was to be. Finally, he was able to discharge his obligation. Naturally, it cannot be said that this is the solution of the puzzle. The men may not have been in every case the same. There is room for other theories, such as that the man concerned, if there was but one, was a medium, and that Jesus, risen from the dead into the afterlife, in the spiritualist sense, spoke through this man in his own voice, etc. Now, of course, other persons who have tried to explain away the resurrection have had to say, ultimately, the disciples lied. They made up the story. Schoenfield recognizes, I think rightly so, that these men were not capable of inventing a lie, and so his theory is to kind of help deal with that problem. He says, there was no deliberate untruth in the witness of the followers of Jesus to his resurrection. On the evidence they had, the conclusion they reached seemed inescapable. There was nothing to tell them to what had happened to the Lord's body. They could not know that the prophet like Moses had been finally laid to rest like Moses himself in an unknown grave. So the dumb group went out and revolutionized the world. Now, as we, understatement... As we look at Schoenfield's thesis and overlay it against the gospel story, we have to ask the question, is this author making a successful reconstruction of history? Several things that could be said. First of all, we should note that this is not the first time that an alternative view has been advanced toward the resurrection of Jesus. Matthew 28 contains the first false report. They stole his body. There have been other theories advanced through history that the disciples stole the body, but this doesn't make sense. How could they have carried off such an enterprise? They were not, after all, cunning or philosophical or even theological people. They were Galilean. Many of them were fishermen and the like. It doesn't make sense that any enemy stole his body, because when the disciples began preaching the resurrection, all that would have been needed was to materialize the body and say, here it is, and the preaching of the resurrection would have stopped. Fact is, Jesus' body is missing. It's a fact of history I think everybody can pretty much agree upon. An old theory has been that Jesus swooned on the cross, that he didn't really die. This is the Islam view, coming all the way from the 7th century and perhaps even existing before then, that somebody carried him off and buried him privately. One ingenious person even suggested that Jesus' body evaporated in the tomb. The lengths some people won't go to have faith. Fact remains, the body is missing. So that's one factor we should look at. This is not the first attempt to explain away the resurrection. And second thing I think we should look at in respect to Schoenfield is the odds against him. What does he need for his views to be valid? I've worked out a list of things that he needs in order for his theory to come true and tried to put some sort of probability on them. And I've been, I think, fairly conservative in the probability I've given to him. For example, he assumes that all the Gospels were written at a very late date, late 1st century or even on to the midpoint of the 2nd century. This is because it fits more conveniently into his theory to suppose the Gospels were written late, because then they weren't written by eyewitnesses but just people pretending to be eyewitnesses and the like. A good deal of scholarship, by the way, in the last couple of decades has moved to a much earlier position toward the Gospels than was previously held. For example, some people used to think 20, 30 years ago that the Gospel of John was written in the midpoint of the 2nd century. Now, when we find papyri that can be precisely dated at 112 AD, quoting the Gospel of John, it's pretty hard to assume John is being written in 150 when he's being quoted in 112. So people have gradually moved that date back more and more. But there's a division between liberal and conservative scholars on the dating of the New Testament, and let's be real generous with Schoenfield and say that he has a 1 in 2 chance of being right on this. I don't really think the chances are that good, but let's be generous. So that thing has to happen. There has to be a late date. The Gospels and the New Testament can't be written by people that are contemporary to the real Jesus. Second thing that must happen is this. Jesus must have two groups of disciples. He must have a secret group, and he must have the obvious group. Now, inasmuch as no one has ever discovered this before in all of history, I would rate Schoenfield's chances of being right on this as about 1 in 10. And again, I think I'm being rather generous. No mention is made of any writing to survive from the period or anything else that Jesus had two groups, the smart one and the dumb one. Third thing that must line up is this. There must be a fraud of first magnitude in Jesus, Joseph of Arimathea, Lazarus, and Nicodemus, which went unrevealed. None of them ever leaked the fraud which they perpetrated, because no one has ever in human history discovered it. Schoenfield is the first one, writing in 1965, to discover the fraud. So when we look at this, we've got to recognize the psychological improbabilities of this. Here is Jesus talking about love and truth, saying, I am the truth, teaching his disciples to be truthful, and sure enough, in the fruit of their lives, they are truthful. They'd rather die than start saying a lie, saying something that wasn't true. And here we have a person on the one hand is doing this, but in the core of his personality, he is psychotic. He is sick to the nth degree. He is a malevolent genius, is the only way to describe this being. And how Schoenfield can express any admiration for Jesus as a man, which he does, is beyond me, in light of the thing which emerges, that Jesus was the biggest fraud that ever lived. The chances of Jesus, Joseph of Arimathea, Lazarus, or Nicodemus not ever breathing the story to anybody, what Schoenfield relates, I'm going to be generous again. I'll rate the chances at 1 in 4. Now, if you're looking at the theory of probability, and you're multiplying fractions, you know you multiply the bottom as it goes along. So in the first instance, we had 1 chance in 2, then 1 chance in 20, or 1 chance in 10, and then we have 1 chance in 4. We're starting to multiply those out. And by the time we come to the third thing that Schoenfield needs to line up, that is, that a fraud had to have been committed, the chances of his being right have now grown to 1 in 80. But let's go on. Let's look at specific facts related to the Passion. For example, Schoenfield notes, as he looks at the Gospel of John, that when Jesus was speared, blood flowed from his side. He fails to note that John says blood flowed and water, which makes a significant difference. It suggests clotting, it suggests death, it suggests that perhaps the pericardium sac has been broken. Schoenfield simply omits the mention of water. His chances of being right on this one, taking part of John and missing part, are about 1 in 2. He also has to very much posit, for his theory to be true, inexperienced executioners. Here are hardened Roman soldiers who have the phrase going around, seen one crucifixion, you've seen them all. They have seen plenty of crucifixions, and they've crucified plenty of people. I would think that with their experience, they would have a reasonable degree of probability in knowing who's dead and who's not dead on the cross. In fact, they had a habit when a person wasn't quite, didn't know for sure if he was dead or not, they'd just come along with a mallet and bang their knees and smash them so that they would collapse on the cross and die of asphyxiation. So they were cruel men, they were hardened men, but they were expert men in what they did, good tradesmen. I would estimate that their probability of being wrong would be about 1 in 100. I doubt if they had missed on too many other people. Also, Schoenfield cannot have guards at the tomb, for if there were guards at the tomb, it makes it impossible for anybody to go back and forth and sneak the body of Jesus out. We'll give him 1 in 2 odds on that. The odds now, if you line up all the probabilities together, have grown to 1 in 32,000. He might be right. Then we've got the factor of the survival of a bleeding body, which has been wounded with 5 bleeding wounds. He has now been encased in wrath with no medical help. Schoenfield omits John's statement that Jesus was embalmed in about, or placed rather, in about 100 pounds of anointing oil or ointments. So if we take the gospel story, he's got 100 pounds of bandages and wrap and ointment and stuff on him, and he's bleeding and he has no medical help, he has no doctor, he's in the cool recesses of a tomb, and magically, as he's brought out into the fresh air after being encased in that, he regains consciousness for just a moment to tell his disciples the end of his plan, the sequel, go tell him, I'll meet him in Galilee. Chances of his being right on that, I think, are about 1 in 100. Let the probability stand at 1 in 3.2 million that he's right. Then we've got Schoenfield completely dismissing the Lord's appearance to Peter, to the 10, to the 11, including Thomas, and the Ascension. Let's give him 1 in 2 out of that. Probability is now 1 in 6.4 million. Let's add to that another factor, the fact that Schoenfield is the first and only person to hold this theory in 1900 years. In fact, since he released his book, no scholar has come to his defense or said, my, isn't that a tremendously important scholarly idea? Let's give his chances there at 1 in 1900. After all, one chance for every year. And let us also suppose that he needs to be right, which he does need to be right if he's correct. He needs to have accurately selected from the Gospels the material that is truth from the material that is fiction. He, for example, indicates that the beloved disciple of John is not John, son of Zebedee. So, you know, and then he can select the parts which fit his story and the parts which don't, he can brush away. The resurrection appearances which fit his story are true. The resurrection appearances which don't fit his story are obviously untrue. The probability of, I think, his being right on this factor, I'll give him a 1 in 5. With the conservative predictive capability, I would estimate that the probability of everything turning out and all the ducks lining up so that Schoenfield would be right now stands at about 1 chance in 60 billion 800 million of his theory being accurate. In addition to these things, it seems to me he leaves out some other important emphasis. He never successfully explains the popularity of Jesus. After all, Jesus did miracles. Schoenfield says, in effect, the miracles were simply the carried away fanaticism of the crowd who thought that he was doing miracles. Jesus may have done some wonderful things, but they couldn't have been all those kinds of things which are being told to us in the gospel. Yet we see Jesus willy-nilly going ahead and doing miracles today anyway, as many of you testify in this audience. My sister who is here was healed of a very bad eye condition. My father is here today who was healed on the mission field after being given a potent poison, and they expected him to die from it in his witnessing activities. So we have to, you know, dismiss miracles completely from the record. Also, we have to somehow, if we look at Schoenfield, account for the change in the dumb disciples. How did a group ever pull off anything so consequential, even if they were being successfully bluffed? What accounts for their courage? And what accounts for the fact that it wasn't the empty tomb that convinced the disciples that Jesus was risen? It wasn't the empty tomb at all. It was the presence of the risen Christ. It was his continually teaching them over the next 40 days, reinterpreting and re-explaining his teachings concerning the kingdom of God to them that made them alive to his presence. It was the power of Pentecost that infused them and gave them a boldness they'd never had before when they were just dumb fishermen out at Galilee. And a third thing that Schoenfield never explains is what would Jesus have done if he had succeeded? Suppose he'd brought off the whole cockamamie scheme and everything had come to pass as he had intended. He bluffed his way through the cross. What's he to go around now? In Galilee making appearances as a kind of a crippled, emaciated Messiah? And when he looks at his hands and his feet and can hardly hobble around, what's he supposed to be doing? And maybe he should go into the recess somewhere. And what did he hope to bring off by this whole plot? Suppose people did believe that it was the Messiah and get a lot of people excited. Can you believe the kinds of things that would occur if he'd have brought the whole thing off? It just taxes one's imagination. Sometimes I feel that when we talk about faith, it takes a lot more faith to be an unbeliever than it takes faith to be a believer. But if you want faith and want to believe in Schoenfield's Passover plot, then you're welcome to all the faith because you're going to need a lot of it. Seems to me what Schoenfield does on a positive side is really tell us something about the strength of the gospel story. For here we have a man who reputes himself to be a modern scholar, and we'll grant that he is a scholar. He, therefore, as a scholar, is familiar with all the theories that have been propounded over the centuries as to how to explain away the resurrection of Christ. He is saying, as a modern man, none of the theories have grabbed him. He's not satisfied with the one.
There must be another theory which has some ring of certitude to it, which is a better explanation than anybody else has ever invented. So what he's saying is, I'm dissatisfied with all the theories in the past, and here's the best theory. And I say, if this is the best theory, then that shows you something about the other theories that have come down the pike. He winds up, it seems to me, strengthening the cause of the gospel far more than taking away from it. Of course, for people that don't think, for people that don't seriously challenge or question, who simply can be moved with a surface reading of a book or a surface viewing of a film, there will no doubt be some kind of impact. Those who will take the time to seriously examine the gospel records, quite another conclusion will result than the conclusion that Schoenfield brings. What the gospel story does tell us, and what this death announcement that we have read this morning does indicate to us, is this. The death of Jesus was purely voluntary. He was not a martyr, and it was not a mistake. He purposed to give his life on our behalf. He thought it was necessary. He not only thought it was necessary, he knew it was necessary that he give his life for us. If there's any other way we could be saved, if there's any other way we could have forgiveness of sin, cleansing from guilt, a home in heaven, and the like, if there's any other way, the cross wouldn't be needed. But the cross is absolutely necessary. And also, Jesus tells us in this death announcement that the cross is a ghastly experience. It was a horrendous experience for him. Suffering was involved. And any time we come to worship the Savior, we must renew and recognize in that renewing the Lord's suffering on our behalf. We have one who proved his love for us on the cross. And I think also what the death announcements are saying to us and what the whole New Testament is saying for us is simply this. His death was for you, and his death was for me. He did it for us. God so loved the world that he gave his only Son, that whoever believes in him shouldn't perish, but have everlasting life. Like the disciples, from time to time, when the death of Jesus is announced to us, we may, as verse 34 states, not understand any of these things, having the saying hid from them and not grasping it. But the Lord, through his risen presence among us, wants us to grasp the reality that he indeed is risen from the dead. And no one can take that from him, no matter how artful the invention or the lie might seek to become. There's a beautiful story of the significance of the cross in the classic Christian classic Pilgrim's Progress. For all down through the ages, persons have found in the cross and in the resurrection of Jesus a remedy for our guilt. John Bunyan expressed it in his picturesque way in describing the pilgrim who he ran thus till he came to a place somewhat ascending, and upon that place stood a cross, and a little below it, at the bottom, a sepulcher. So I saw in my dream that just as Christian came up to the cross, his burden loosed from off his shoulders and fell from his back and began to tumble, and so continued to do till it came to the mouth of the sepulcher, where it fell in, and I saw it no more. Then was Christian glad and lightsome and said with a merry heart, he hath given me rest by his sorrow and life by his death. Then Christian gave three leaps for joy and went on singing. I came to the cross with my burden, and it rolled off, back, tumbled down into the open sepulcher, and I saw it no more. Christ's death is for you, and it is for me. And because of it, he sets us free from sin and eternal death and invites us to fellowship in his presence this very moment. What a Savior, and what a Lord. Would you take of communion today with joy and thanksgiving in your heart for the reality of the gospel and for the love God has had toward you?